I'm a Jonah Ray, and sometimes I'm Ray.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast, you know, number 472.
Ironic is that John Williams will receive no royalties from the ASP for what we just did.
So, with that in mind, we'd like to thank ASCAP, who let us record the Paul Williams podcast at the ASCAP offices. And so before we get to Paul Williams, I'll say that a bunch of we're all doing a bunch of shows at SF Sketchfest. Yes. I do believe the Nerdist Podcast show is sold out.
All right.
But
who's our guest?
It'll be a surprise to even us. Okay. But I'm also doing the Revenge of the Nerds screening and then the Q&A with the cast. I'm doing Bring the Rock, and I'm also doing a live Sanjay and Craig reading the Saturday, February 8th.
That's Saturday, cool. February 8th as well. I will be at the Lost Weekend Video Cinecave doing a live Jonah Radio with guest Ben Garant and live band The Manx coming up from Los Angeles to perform. It's a live Jonah Radio. It should be a lot of fun.
Nice. Matt?
And then if you miss Jonah Radio in the afternoon, you can see him at 10 p.m. at the Eureka Theater. Tom Lennon and I are doing a show called One Star with a lot of great people. Lorraine Newman. Michael Hitchcock, good improviser from the Christopher Guest movies. Jonah, of course, Eddie Pepitone, Doug Benson, Ben Garant. Lots of good people are going to be on that show. Come see it. It's at 10 o'clock at the Eureka Theater.
Fantastic. I like the Eureka. It's a really nice space. I would like to thank Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. That's an all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store.
You know I've heard about this on Earwolf.
Yeah, why? I know you don't listen to our podcast, Matthew.
Well, I just want to tell you, I think Squarespace is great. They say a lot of good things about it.
For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code NERDIST1.
Oh, that's not the one I use.
Guy, why? Squarespace is constantly improving the platform. They have new features, new designs. Even better support.
It's just a way to get a professional website done.
It's about time, person. It's 2014.
Seriously.
Make your thing. Fuck your Tumblr.
Here's something that's fun. Here's a thing I should have done. MattMyra.com.
Yep.
You'd think it's a website. You'd think I'd have purchased that domain at some point. Mm-hmm. I didn't.
Not too
so
late.
When you type in MattMyra.com, someone has purchased it already.
Oh.
And it will redirect you to a Google search for pizza cats.
See, if Matt had had Squarespace, he would not be universally associated with pizza cats.
But you know what?
You're okay
with it? Totally okay with it.
All right. So go to squarespace.com, start building your high-quality website portfolio or online store.
Maybe you want to make a website about pizza cats.
Use the offer code NERDIST1 and live it up with 10% off and a free trial.
Oh, God. You know what? The support's there all the time.
Who is?
The support.
Yeah.
Squarespace.
They have great support to help you manage any level of programming. If you want to do CSS or just if you just want to work off templates, whatever skill level you have, they'll help you out. Squarespace.com. This episode was a Paul Williams returning. It's the 100th anniversary of ASCAP, and so like I said, we were at ASCAP offices, and so I love Paul Williams. The first time he came on, it was one of those ones that I think people. We're like, Paul Williams, like, oh, okay, yeah, he wrote all the songs and he did the Muppet movie soundtrack. And he's okay. And then it turned out to be, like, I think one of our best podcasts ever.
It was a lot of fun.
He was I love Paul Williams. Phenomenal. Such a wonderful guy. So when he came back on, I said to, when it was being booked, I was like, oh, do you think Paul would do a song? And so they pitched it to him and they said, well, what do you want him to do? And I go, well, I'm going to go back there someday from the Muppet movie. It's like, I know Rainbow Connection gets a lot of love, but I'm going to go back there someday. And it might actually be my favorite song in the Muppet movie soundtrack.
Yeah.
It's the one that Gonzo sings when they're out in the desert.
Paul
tells a story about it. I'll let him tell the stories. But so he agreed to do the song, and so here's what happened. So he had this accompanist come in. The accompanist is playing. Paul starts singing. Then he stops and he was like, "Nah, no, I messed up the lyrics. It doesn't feel right." So he goes over and stands by the piano and he starts singing again. He goes, "Nah, it still just doesn't feel right." So he gets all the way through it and he's like, "Okay, I guess that's fine." And then we're about to wrap up the podcast, and I go, oh, I just loved, I think I said something, it's in the, you'll hear in the podcast, but I was like, this looks familiar. Like, I start doing this Gonzo voice, just kind of reflexively, because I'm annoying and I do voices. And then Paul goes, hey, you know what? You should sing this with me.
Oh, no.
As that. And I was like, what? And so I was like, okay. So I went up and we just impromptu sang it. Like, we went back and forth.
No way. You remembered all the lyrics?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, we,
he knows them. I mean.
And so we sang it. And then Paul goes, he goes, that is the version that we were supposed to do. He said, that is the version. He said, I was, you know, he was like, I was trying to capture it before and I was forcing it, but this is the one you have to post. And he was insistent. So I apologize. I know it sounds self-indulgent that I'm going to post the one that I sang with him on. And I'm doing kind of a crappy Gonzo voice, but it, to me, it was like, it was one of those, how is this my life scenarios.
That sounds
like,
neat.
I'm here with, and also kind of captured the theme of what we were talking about in the podcast, because he had just had some of those experiences too.
Yeah.
Where he had gone to an award show and Bonnie Raitt was there and all these people. He was like, how am I here? And I'm sure at the Grammys when he was up there, yeah, you know, for Daft Punk,
with,
he must
when
have
he was
been
up there with Macklemore.
How am I here? You know, like, and then also, you
also
know,
a guest of the Nerdist podcast.
That the song was like a little imperfect and he was talking about how much better, like, things are, that just they have more personality. So
yeah,
it actually kind of weirdly encapsulated, I think, what the whole theme of the podcast was, but I was so completely honored to be a part of it and to have him on again, and I fucking love the guy.
That's
so
great.
Nerdist Podcast number 472 with Paul Williams.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Oh, that's such a come on, see?
Yeah. Thank you.
And almost, it's almost upsetting how good that song is. And wow, also just amazing that I mean, I watched the video on YouTube again last night. I watched it again last night. But just watching Gonzo, just so much expression from just this little guy.
Dave Gultz is one of the most spectacular actors and directors, and I mean, what his work encompasses is just is beyond. It's brilliant, and it's all heart. I mean, there's such intellect and heart and compassion in that little character. And you know, Gonzo is my favorite Muppet. You know, that's the one that I feel is. If I was going to be a Muppet, that would have to be Gonzo. He's a landlocked bird. You know, hey, Chris, we're all landlocked birds.
I guess that's true. I think I would be a cross between Fozzie and Gonzo, sort of like the waka 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 guy and the one that just always feels a little out of place.
Yeah. And there's a little bit of Ratso in all of us, too.
it's so amazing to have you back on the podcast because when you came on the first time, I mean, I knew it was going to be I assumed, like, oh, this is going to be a really nice chat, but it was a phenomenal conversation that we had. And, you know, a lot of people listen to the podcast, but every so often there's one that people that just catches people's attention. It just sticks in their brains. And I got so much feedback about you from the last time you were on.
I got so much feedback. I had no idea that I was going to get the kind of response that I did. And, you know, but it's about conversation. You know, my life has been about shoe leather. Is that opportunity walks up to me in shoe leather. There's nothing more important than relationship, you know. So, and ultimately, what you do is, I hope, as it is for me, is a labor of love. Yeah, it's a labor, but there's such affection in it, and I think people can hear that, you know. And you have a very hip audience. You have a very eclectic audience. You guys write to the guys that listen to the podcast, write to me, and they. I mean, it's everything from I'm going to go back there someday, and songs from the Muppet movie to, you know, to stuff from about the Battle of the Planet of the Apes to intellectual property rights. I mean, it's they're really interesting guys, and you know, and we're pretty interesting, aren't we?
I hope. I mean, I find that you know, as many times as I've messed up in this life that hopefully coming through on the other side makes you slightly more interesting, because you're like, oh yeah, I went through that, and here's, don't do that again.
That's where wisdom is born. Somebody pointed out, you know, it's, you're like, you make mistakes, and that's where your wisdom is born, and it's the capacity to take that mistake and learn from it, and then pass on something sweeter, you know, in your next efforts, you know. It's, you know, ultimately, I get up in the morning, and I have a short prayer that I always say. I say, lead me where you need me. And if I'm led where I'm needed during the day, I don't feel like I'm in the way. You know, and if I feel like I'm in the way, I get noisy and loud and stupid and do dumb things and all. But if I feel like I'm actually okay and the people are okay with me being where I am, something rolls out of me that where I get comfortable and I get creative and I listen. I become the one of the things that I want to become in the years ahead. And I don't know how many years ahead I have. I'd love to have another 20 or 30 years on this, you know, this little spinning ball of gravity. But I hope that I become a better listener is what I would put at the top of my list of what I'd like to improve in. Be a better listener, Paulie.
You mean not just listening to people, but just sort of listening to the world in general?
Yeah, exactly.
In the environment.
Listen to people's stories. I mean, you know, we're so, you know, I think that I you know, was plowing ahead trying to make a world for myself, create a career or a life for myself and all. I think that as I get older, in some ways I'm more productive because I slow down in other areas of my life. And one of the areas, hopefully I slow down a little bit, is in that self-pursuit of trying to just keep improving my life and listen to the lives of people around me. And those are the gifts. And that's where I hear what becomes the songs. You know, ultimately, everything I write is, I think, born from the people that walk up to me. You know, it's the love of people that becomes music.
Well,
I don't know.
Because essentially you're retelling stories.
I think we all are. You know, I think in anybody that is in the creative process, that's part of what we're doing, is we're hearing what's going on around us. We're and when you reflect the truth back to somebody, you give them a great gift, you know. So, you know, so Chris makes a mistake and, you know, he steps in and there's mud on your boots. You can share that information with people around you and make their lives better and all. And the fact that you do it in an entertaining fashion, that you make people laugh while you do it, makes that spoonful of medicine go down a lot easier.
I try. I mean, I think it's one of the reasons why we like vintage things so much, is because things that are naturally worn have a story. Like, oh, that lived some type of life, and there's the, you know, kind of the muck of just experiences, yeah, that surround that thing, even if we don't know what they are.
Yeah, if those cufflinks could talk, you know. And there's energy to those things, you know. It's like have you ever picked up an old watch, and you know, or you know, you're browsing around an antique store, and you walk over and you pick up an old watch or a pocket watch or glasses after somebody's gone. You pick up, I mean, talk about a really interesting feeling. I remember after my dad passed away, looking at his glasses, and I don't think to this day, in my 70s, I don't think I can express what it felt like to hold his glasses that he had looked at the world through. I mean, I'm 13 years old, so I'm not very, you know, I don't have the ability to really translate what I'm feeling. But I remember today, and we're talking about 60 years later, how it felt to hold his glasses, and he looked at the world through this. What is the energy like around this object and all? I don't know if I can identify the energy around the object, but I'm beginning to get to a place where I can identify what I was feeling at the time, and it was, I think, a sense of time moving on. You know, it's going to move on with me. Someday these glasses that I'm wearing, is, you know, if they don't go through the windshield of a car, you know, these glasses will be intact, and somebody will be sitting there and holding them and go, well, what did he get to see looking through these glasses? What he got to see was a life that he couldn't have imagined. I am, you know, I'm writing a book with Tracy Jackson, and I are writing a book called Gratitude and Trust. Recovery, yeah, is not just for addicts. And the essence of my life has come down to those two words, gratitude and trust. I am so grateful for everything that I've experienced, and I think especially the mistakes, the 10 years I lost, you know, to my addiction. You know, you're an alcoholic when you misplace a decade. You know? So I misplaced the 80s. The 80s were gone. I found out later that Reagan was president. But, wow,
the
you
actor?
Kidding? The actor? You're joking. But I think that those years are probably the most important years of my life. I mean, now, because I can A, use them, use them to, you know, to help, you know, deal with other people recognizing their own addiction and the fact that there's hope for the hopeless. But also just the perspective that it gives me on time and how quickly it goes by and how to use it, really lovingly. You know, it's all about, ultimately, it's, as corny as it sounds, it is all about love and service. It's all about love and service. And if you can do, and it's a really great magic trick, if you can do what you love and be of service to the world. I mean, if you can do what you love and be of service to the world.
That's an amazing feat to pull off.
Spectacular, yeah.
Well, it's funny you say that. My dad, who died last year, he said the same thing you said, where he misplaced his 30s because
he did him right.
Yeah, he misplaced his 30s just because, you know, he was in the pits of despair, and so he just sort of drank his way through his 30s, and you know, but he had a really good perspective on it because he said, I don't like regret, because if I had changed any one thing about my life, I wouldn't be here with you now.
Yeah.
And so he was really good at sort of doing the sort of mental maintenance on, like, you know, that's what I had to go through, yeah, to get to this point. And so ultimately it was worth it.
Yeah, exactly. And the parts that look the most negative at the moment that they're happening sometimes turn out to be a gift. And I think I actually talked to you about this once before, about I'm totally convinced that Noah is a gift in our world, that there is Noah's a navigational nudge. You know, if I don't get something that I really want, I mean, it's like, you know, a classic example. I went to, I was sober a couple years. I was kind of away from music. I'd lost touch with the music, and all of a sudden, I was hired to do a movie in New Zealand called The Frighteners.
Oh, yes.
You know, I mean, a great, you know,
it's a Michael J. Fox movie.
Exactly, Michael J. Fox.
It's a great movie. Great ghost movie.
So they hire me to play the John Astin role. So it's like, oh, my God, they wanted John Astin, but they couldn't get him. So they call me, and I wind up getting the part. They booked the plane tickets and all. I mean, I was a couple years sober at the time. And it's like, I'm really, really excited about this because I'm, you know, I started out as an actor. I love acting. There's a chance to act again and all. It's great and everything. And then I get a phone call. You know what? John Astin's schedule changed, so he's able to do it. And I don't think that I, you know, like in a game of hopscotch, you just stop on a number for a second. That's about how long I felt any disappointment. Because what I felt immediately, and this was totally new for me because I could do a poor me for a decade, you know, my immediate thought was, what's coming? What? There's something. There's a reason for me to not go to New Zealand. What is it? The next day, I got a phone call from an organization called NSAI, the Nashville Songwriters Association International. They said, we'd like you to come to Nashville. We're going to honor you at a thing called Tin Pan South. Now, I used to be, at that point, a songwriter. I was a used-to-be songwriter. I go to Nashville, and there's something in the water. And I meet the people down there, and they make me feel safe. Big point right there. They make me feel safe. They respect me. I start getting this feeling of, like, I could maybe do this. I meet a guy named John Vesner. We sit down and wrote a song called You're Gone. It was the number one record for Diamond Rio. All of a sudden, I'm in love with music again, and in a whole new way. I'm sitting down at a kitchen table with a guy that I never met before, telling him the truth about what I feel, listening to his truths, collaborating in a fashion that I'd never collaborated before, because my collaborations before, even the most successful, at their heart, there was something that was ego-driven. But to sit down with somebody and just go, you tell me your – come on, Chris, you tell me your mistake, and I'll tell you mine, you know. And I would be willing to bet that you and I sitting here right now could write a song. And it would, if I don't know how good it would be, but it would have a flavor of honesty that people would respond to.
And that's ultimately what people, that's the sort of ingredient X in something, and not just music, but in comedy or in anything, where there's just some little authentic nugget of, can tell when someone's real and when they're faking it. And when you do identify that one thing, it's...
And the fact is that the reason that a song is successful is not because I'm so different and I write something unique and different, but what we have in common. It's like, for me, there's great safety at the center of the herd. You know, it's like there's safety at the center of the herd. When I write about, you know, I'm just not educated enough to write really brilliant, you know. I mean, I tried. The more intellectual I got in my writing, the further away I got from what I felt and the less successful the songs were. But when I just say Pauly, And I write, you know, what scares me or what I need or what I long for. And they're usually Ouch Mommy songs. I've always called them codependent anthems, you know. Pick me up and love me. You know, I'm nothing without you songs. When I can write honestly, no matter how, and without fear of having being laughed at. Without fear of being laughed at, just saying, this is who I am right now. I'm really scared. I wish you'd pick me up and hold me. Somebody out there is going, boy, I know how it feels to be that scared. Maybe they're that scared now, or maybe they'd been that way before. Maybe they're looking at their kid and go, boy, I know how my kid feels because I hear it in that song. Then by being the same, we have spotlighted some of the elegance of human spirit.
Well, it's hard to, I mean, first of all, so two things I'll say to that. Number one, not everyone would have gotten passed over for a Zemeckis movie. I think it was Zemeckis, right? Frighteners was, yeah, was Zemeckis. Yeah. And then immediately said, oh, what's coming next? They would have been crushed. And it would have taken a while for them to go, oh, why does this always happen to me? Because sure. They build the story. You know, you live the story that you build in yeah. your head. Yeah. So if you do the, this always happens to me, and then you start looking for other things to build that case, then you do manifest that reality.
Absolutely. And you just said in like two sentences what is essentially my spiritual philosophy is the thought. Thoughts are things. What we dwell on, we create. As a man thinketh in his heart. If I sit there and go, well, one more time, as you just said, if one more time, I never get what I want. That's a prayer. I never get what I want. You're putting that out into the universe. You're helping to co-create that. But if you go, phew, and the way you get to a place where you can go, phew, something wonderful must be coming, is you have to screw up just righteously for about a decade. You know, you have to wake up in your own spittle and kind of going, oh, my God, now what have I done? Or be so messed up you don't even realize you're messed up.
Yeah.
You know, that was the great thing about the – one of the great things for me anyway about the movie Paul Williams Still Alive is because it offered me a chance to look at myself. I mean, there's footage in that movie of me just so messed up. So arrogant, shallow, vapid little person hosting Merv Griffin, so full of himself that he can't even see the world around him. And for me to see that kind of arrogance and grandiosity and ego is a huge life lesson, you know. So I'm not sure where I was headed with this, except that out of, you know, that feeling of, oh my God, I screwed up again and all, is there's something about that is ultimately what's the word I'm looking for? It's the opposite of constructive. It's a destructive behavior. But what you said right before that is it's a longer process. Everybody has their own process to get to grieve. You know, and if it takes you 6 months to grieve over something, I think that's where you are in your life right now. But hopefully you can advance to a place where you go, you know what, that happened, there's something better coming.
Well, yeah, the number two thing that makes me think is, it's something I heard once. I heard someone say once that no matter what you think about yourself, you're right.
Oh my God, I love that. Yeah, exactly.
No matter what, if you think shitty things about yourself, well then you're going to manifest that, and
exactly.
You're right. If you think positive things, or you think like, you know, like you
I am
said,
a small mound of poo poo, you become a small mound of poo poo.
Yeah,
you go,
exactly.
I am a, you know, a righteous, you know, yeah, absolutely.
Because I think your brain is essentially a machine that is kind of like an assistant, and I think a lot of people feel ruled by their brain, but I think it's sort of an assistant. So if you say like, ah, I suck and everything's bullshit, then your brain will go out and go, look, oh, here's more examples of that. Here, I'm trying to make you,
all right,
know.
All like, right, here, guess what I got you for.
This is what you said. This is what you asked for.
You said you suck at everything. Yeah. Guess what I got you for Christmas? A basketball. You know? So then I can take the basketball and go on the court and prove to myself that I suck at everything.
Well, so it's figuring out a way to change the, and where I think most people don't realize is that you can change the dialogue with yourself, and you can start asking better questions when bad things happen, like you just said, you know, well, I mean, this is good. Yeah. What could be around the corner?
There's something there. You know?
What can I learn from this? How can I grow from this?
Yeah, and that's a long process. That's everybody has their own road to that clarity.
But even just starting to ask better questions, I think is the first. I mean, I think, you know, even though you might not feel like, oh, my life has been dramatically altered overnight, you do sort of first feel that, aha, wait, maybe I have some control over this. And then incrementally, you know, after a few months, that's when it starts to...
And beyond that, I did things in my 30s that were ignored by the world that could have been very quickly labeled a failure, now in 2014... Okay, here's a classic example. In 1974, I made a movie called Phantom of the Paradise.
Of course.
Phantom of the Paradise, which was totally... I mean, it was a huge flop in this country. There were only two cities in the world where it had any real success. Winnipeg... in Canada and Paris, France. Okay, so let's write it off as a failure. Maybe you could do that, but all of a sudden, you know, I'm in Mexico, and a 16-year-old boy comes up to me at a concert with an album, a Phantom of the Paradise soundtrack, and asked me to sign it. I signed it. Evidently, I was nice to him, and we had a nice little conversation. I don't remember the moment. I remember the signing album. I don't know if I think I remember or if I actually remember, but this little 14, 16, or whatever this guy was. Well, I know who the guy is now because I'm writing a musical based on Pan's Labyrinth with him. It's Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah.
The work that I've done with Daft Punk is totally related to them seeing Phantom of the Paradise 20 times and going, you know, and deciding that they're going to reach out to this, you know, this 70-year-old songwriter to get involved in an album called Random Access Memories. So what is the lesson in that? The lesson for me is be very careful about what you label a failure in your life. Be very careful about throwing something in the round file as garbage. Because you may find that it is the headwaters of a relationship that you can't even imagine that is coming in your future.
Well, also, it's just not as black and white as this is a failure and that's not a failure. Like, if you even if something flops or you mess something or you completely mess something up, you can still... I mean, it's all right to be bummed about things for a couple... I think it's okay. Like, you kind of mourn the loss of the thing that you cared about.
Sure.
But then... you can go back through almost parasitically and sort of figure out, dissect, you know, what pieces of this can I still use? Maybe it's not all a complete loss. Can I reappropriate this to something else? Or at least what's the lesson that I learned from this? But I think as long as you can experience some type of growth, no matter what happens, then you can almost be... from one point of view, kind of bulletproof in that way.
And the other element we haven't even talked about is magic. The other thing we haven't talked about is this mysterious, amazing energy. You know, I mean, I've used electricity my entire life. I don't have a clue about how it works. I mean, and when I was an alcoholic and drinking alcoholic, and you ask me how something worked, I would tell you if I didn't know or not. You know, now I'm going to be in the middle of explaining. If somebody says, how does a jet engine work? I'll be about three sentences into it when I'll stop myself and go, I have no idea. What are you talking about? You lying little bastard. You don't know anything about jet engines at all. But I use electricity, and I don't know how it works. There is an element in the universe. There is something in the universe that is becoming more and more and more obvious to me that is a major part of our lives. I'll give you an example. And it's as recent as yesterday. You know, I have gratitudeandtrust.com, the website where Tracy and I are blogging, building a readership for our book when the book comes out in September. So day before yesterday, I sit down and I write a blog. Somebody just sent me a picture of that they took of me in the middle of a crash at Watkins Glen when I was racing at a Toyota Celebrity Grand Prix. I raced it, you know, a bunch in the early 80s and late 70s. But then somebody sent me this picture of me with a car up on its nose and everything. It's got one half on the side because I raced under the number one half, you know. and it's got this picture of me, and it's like I'm just absolutely out of control going through a fence. I'm practically upside down. It was a great picture. And I thought, that's what the competitive spirit does for you. So I wrote a blog, which hasn't posted yet, but I wrote a blog. This is the day before yesterday. I wrote a blog about the competitive spirit. That, you know, that when I'm trying to take something from somebody else, it doesn't really work for me. And I talked about, you know, I also talked about what I've learned about myself and how I'd probably really love to race again. So, I mean, as you know, because I'm now sober and I have a quieter soul and I have clarity, I think I'd be better or whatever, blah, blah, blah. I checked my email this morning and yesterday, last night, I got an email from the people that run the Long Beach Grand Prix asking me if I'd like to come and race again. Now, this was a day after I wrote a blog that has not been posted yet. And it's so, I mean, it's like, where's the connection? There's some sort of a communication on some level that is going on that is just pure mystery. I mean, I can't do it. I've got to be in New York and D.C. the times of the race and all, but maybe I'll be able to do it next year. But what's more exciting to me than the race or the possibility of getting back into that racing suit when I'm not 40 pounds overweight like I was then,
there's
fact that I could think of something and this magical, mysterious little process takes place where I don't know if I sensed it before it came in or writing the blog created the opportunity. I'll never know, but it fascinates me.
Yeah, or there was just some type of energy in the magnetosphere that you both picked up on at the same time. Yeah. I don't know, because I've had, you know, I like to think there's something sciencey behind it that we just don't yet understand, of just being, you know, all essentially vibrating molecules as part of the same system, that there's just something disrupts the force. And so like the same thing happened to me.
Subatomic particles that when you get there's nothing there. just proof that they have been there. Wait
yes.
a minute. How do you explain that?
I know, but it's, you know, but there's something quantum about it. And so, you know, when I started the whole Nerdist everything, it was just kind of having this moment where I said, I think I really should only pursue things that I actually care about that revolve around these things that I'm passionate about. And
what's
just,
your greatest passion?
What's my greatest passion? I think comedy, probably, I would say, you know, like I hate to say, like, well, making people laugh. I mean, I guess it's part of that, but it's performing and connecting with people.
You keep going.
No, worries.
You're on a great roll.
No worries. I think it's just, it's that sort of communal thing of, like, you know, making people feel okay about things with jokes. I mean, raunchy jokes, but still jokes. And then also just feeling like I'm a big collaborator. I love community. I love, you know, like, hey, we can all win. We can all do this together. I think projects where people come together are better, for me anyway, than just sitting alone and like, I just wrote this all by myself. Like, I just like making things with other people. I think the chemistry that you and I would make would be something totally different than something Katie and I would make. Like, it's that sort of chemical thing that happens when you mash different entities and energies together.
And again, that mystical thing that we're talking about, everybody experiences. You're thinking to somebody and the phone rings and it's them.
Yeah.
You know, it's just again and again.
Yeah, and when I decided to do all this stuff, within 2 weeks, I found this job. Because my eyes were open, and I narrowed down all my options. But it gave me a path, like it gave me a focus, like a path. And then this job opened up at Wired Magazine. That was like, well, this is the thing that I was just talking about 2 weeks ago.
Isn't that amazing?
It's incredible. Yeah, I can't believe it. Yeah. Well, how did this happen? I just, you know.
Well, you told the universe what you wanted. You put in your order.
I guess I did.
You put in your order.
Yeah.
And I think we've all, with our thoughts on a daily basis, we put in our order.
And it was a different feeling than that feeling of, I want $1 million. Like, it was definitely like, I just sort of felt something in my body align and go, yeah, this is what means something to me. It's like, you know, when people talk about how they want things or they, oh, I just want this success or this relationship or this money or whatever, I think they don't really think about why. And I think that's an important question to ask. Well, why do you want those things? Well, I want to feel a certain way. Well, what do you want to feel? Well, I want this and this and this. Oh, well, now that I know that these are the things that I need to feel or I want to feel, maybe I don't need those things to feel that. Maybe I can, maybe I already have those things and I just don't know it yet.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's like, the older I get, the further away I get from attaching the way I feel to a place or a thing, you know. I mean, driving over here, I look up on the hills and I see a house that I lived in for 30 years, and I sold it after my second marriage when I got a divorce and sold the house. And it's like, I look at it, I go, my God, you bought that house. You love that house. Peter Lorre died in your den. When do you ever get to say that? You know, I mean, what an amazing house. Orson Welles lived there. I used to get junk mail for Orson Welles. It was, you know, I actually
Columbia
had...
Columbia Record House,
I had,
Orson Welles.
I had a great...
15 albums for a penny?
A great show. I had dinner with Orson Welles once after Tonight Show. He was a host of the Tonight Show. and he requested his guests that night. And it was George Gobel, Flip Wilson, and myself.
Two other phenomenal comedians.
I mean, a really interesting combination of weird people that I loved, you know, including me now. But so I had dinner afterwards, and I said, you know, I live at a place where you used to live, up on Franklin. He said, 8545 Franklin. I said, yes. And he said, I said, it was, what, 30 years ago or whatever at that time. He went, no, but I will always remember it. I shall tell you why. I just moved into it. He said, I rented the house from the, I think it was owned by Sidney Toler, the guy that played the original Charlie Chan. He owned it. He rented it to Orson Welles. He said, I just moved into it. He said, I had to go to court to testify for a friend who was a liar and a thief. So I was a character witness for this friend of mine. He says, I went into the court, and he says, I went up on the stand, and the judge says, please just state your name, your occupation, and your address. I said, my name is Orson Welles. I am a writer and a director and an actor, and I live it, and I couldn't remember the address. He said, so I made one up. I said, 429 King's Rotting Hammerstein, whatever. You know. And he said, as soon as I said the word, the address that I totally made up, I remembered 8545 Franklin. And I thought, okay, at some point, there's going to be a knock on the door, and somebody will say, there is no something King's Rottingham. You're under arrest for lying on the stand. You know, so he remembered it his entire life. You know, but I back to the whole point of driving up La Cienega, and I look up on the hill, and I see that house where I had these amazing memories with my children and everything. I have no connectedness at all of ownership or loss that it's not mine anymore. And it amazes me because I'm a sentimental guy. Why am I all of a sudden, why have I lost this feeling of attachment to things? When did that happen and how did that happen? And why is a place, you know, just not that important to me anymore? I mean, and I love where I live. I love my wife and I love the life I have, you know, and But I, for some reason, there's a kind of a, maybe it's a progressive disconnectedness that prepares us for the big goodbye, you know, but, you know, which is hopefully 20 or 30 years away, who knows when. I mean, I'm pretty optimistic, but I'm 73. But on some level, I find myself being able to love things without possessing them in a greater and greater fashion.
Well, I don't attach that. I mean, I like things. Things are fun, but I think that's really where it ends for me. It's like, oh, they're fun.
This message has been brought to you by the Poly Lama.
Well, I have a pretty snazzy car, and I like it because it's a pretty car. But I don't really, you know, if someone, you know, like if my girlfriend's getting out of the car and she kind of, you know, like scrapes the door of the curb, she's like, oh my god, I'm sorry about your car. I'm like, I don't give a shit. It's a car. Yeah, it's like a car. I don't know. Yeah, it's like it's a car. It doesn't matter. It should just be here to be fun and you know.
And I think it's a process. It's like we evolve into these things and all, you know. But you know, my Instagram account is at polylama2 is polylama2 It's kind of a joke amongst my friends that I am the Pali Lama. All of a sudden, I am, you know, how do you get to be a spiritual giant? Well, you wake up enough mornings in a row not knowing who you are or where you are or who that person is next to you. You instead of coming to one morning, you wake up and then you have almost 24 years of a life of absolute gratitude. You begin to become the Pali Lama.
But isn't it nice to know that you could just put up one Instagram picture and someone could connect with that. Or you could say, you could just send something, you could write a blog or something. And then one person, it could not only change the course of their life, but then the sort of pyramid, the charitable pyramid scheme that could happen of like, well, then that guy takes something from that and then that affects 10 other people.
And that's it.
I mean, it really is like, It's such a it's a legacy that unfortunately you probably won't ever get to, you won't get to see most of it.
Yeah.
But you kind of, it's kind of nice to know that something like that is there. I mean, I think the real measure of a person is just sort of the halo effect of the lives that they affected when they're gone. And I think that's what you leave behind, not like, I mean, it's nice to have stuff. It's fun to look at glasses and go, oh, my dad had this. But just to know, like, oh, all these lives were affected by actions that person had. I think that's where that's the legacy that people should focus on.
I remember being like about 3 days sober, just out of the hospital and rehab and all, and driving down the street and having this intense gratitude for what I was feeling. And I remember looking at a building that was painted a really horrible shade of green. And for some reason, I thought, I thought about the painter getting the phone call that day and saying, would you come and work? And he got a job and turned to his wife and saying, you know, honey, I got the job. I'm going to paint. They've asked me to paint the building on Fountain. You know, so he goes to work. And what it felt, I mean, forget about the bad color that somebody chose, but somebody got the job to do that. And how it felt to go, I'm going to bring home food to my kids with that work. You know, if you chase it, you can find some amazing beauty in every direction you look in. You know, I am disgusting sometimes. Sometimes I make myself sick. I'm so positive. I just hold on. I have to slap myself.
I know. Well, no, it's I feel that way too, because I'm I get very excited about things pretty easily. But I think it's important to realize, even if just the lesson behind that is like, hey, just stop and take a minute and appreciate something for a second.
Yeah.
It will change your day to do that. Just to take a minute out of your day to just stop and go, hey, you know what? That's a really nice thing, or I feel this, or I'm in this moment right now and this is really nice. It will literally change your day, even if you're having a completely shitty day. Just that moment can change your day, which will in turn change other people's days. And it's,
yeah.
And I just feel like people forget that you can do that, because it's just get caught up and busy. And
you're turning a new page to a journal. You go, okay, I'm starting right here. This is zero. I'm setting at zero. We're starting right now. I mean, if I wake up in the morning and I have a grumpy moment or whatever, and I usually don't, and all there's the chances immediate. And that's a huge part of recovery. That's why we say one day at a time. You know, you wake up, you go, all right, this is a clean slate. Go out there and fill it with something wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, first of all, I don't care if people think it's too saccharine, because I know that the people who are sort of ready to hear it the right way will appreciate it. And I always tell, I have these conversations with my girlfriends I have these conversations with my girlfriend.
Chris just saw his life pass before his eyes.
Girlfriends that I have, of the many girlfriends that I have.
Yeah. For all the girls he's about to love, now that the one he's with is going to dump him over that last remark.
I've dated two girls in 10 years. But sometimes, like, when we go out of town and, you know, like, we don't take care of ourselves as well. Or we eat crappy and we don't exercise, you know, and she'll go like, oh, man, it's just all that, you know, all that time I was taking care of myself back home was ruined. And I go, no, it's not. Because when you get home, just take care of yourself again. I'll take care. That's why it doesn't bother me. I'll go, oh, well, just, you know, it's within a week, I'll feel normal again. It's fine. Any second you have to make a decision is a moment that an opportunity you can have to change your life.
So Tracy Jackson, the woman that I'm writing the book with, took me into a Nike store and we bought Nike Fuel Bands. Do you know what they are?
I do, yeah. I had a Fuel Band. What's your score today? What are you up to?
I've got a Fuel Band and it's absolutely disgusting, because I've become now addicted to a little number on my wrist, you know. So I go, Fuel, it's 1,631. My day, my fuel setting is 3,000. So yep. I know that I will probably make my goal again today.
Yeah, but you will, because right now it's only 1,250. I know, but it's hard. You know, it's like we like data and points and things to measure, and you know, and 3,000 means you're pretty active for the day if you get up to 3,000.
Yeah, you get it, and it does that little goal thing and all. Yeah, you can hear somebody yelling, score.
Yeah,
score.
And boy, if you get to like 3,500 or 4,000, like, oh my god, I got some surplus points today.
And at zero, it's at midnight, it's back to zero.
It's back to zero again. Exactly. Yeah, but you also exercise every morning.
I ran 2 miles this morning. You know, I got to bed around 1 a.m. We woke up at 7 and ran 2 miles and everything. Call 911.
The disturbing thing is to know that you are currently, when you're back in New York, you're running during this time of year, which is like a record winter horribleness.
Saw the picture.
I follow you on Twitter. Yeah, I see the pictures. I just see this bundled up. You almost look like a Tusken Raider from Star Wars. Where just like you just see your eyes poking out from all these clothes.
I don't bend. If I fell down, I couldn't get up. You know, I've got so many clothes on, I don't bend at all. Yeah, but I'm in New York a lot for ASCAP, and it's our 100th year's anniversary. So we're doing a lot. I'm spending a lot of time on airplanes and loving my life.
The American Society of Composers, Artists, and Publishers.
Authors and Publishers.
Exactly.
We had to get, you know, it was AA that we had Artisans in there for a while, but nope. they kept you know, setting fire to all their sheet music and we couldn't keep track of it.
So ASCAP's 100 years old.
100 years old, yeah, 1914.
That's amazing.
100 years of you know, we're almost 500,000 members. You know, these people cranking out Labor of Love. It's a labor of love, but it's, like I say, it's still a labor. And so ASCAP has been putting food on the table for my kids and gas in the car to take my daughter to school for since 1972 for me.
Wow.
And, you know, so, and the big message is to the people that love music, we love that you get the music, and we always want you to get the music for the most reasonable price and free if you can get it for free. But the people that bring it to you, the people that sell advertising on the radio and stuff like that, they need to give some of that money that they get for advertising and send it to the people that are writing, you know, creating the music. And that's what ASCAP does. We're almost 500,000 small businessmen. I always said that metaphorically I am the perfect president for ASCAP. I'm a small businessman. we license, blanket license, just every genre of music, you know, from Irving Berlin to Beyonce, and every genre, urban, you know, Latin, huge Latin market, and all just great music, and people get to enjoy it.
Well, let me ask you this about something that you said earlier has been sticking in my mind, which is, you know, writing music, it's sort of expressing that honest moment, you know, whatever someone's feeling, just being as honest as possible. That's not always easy to translate things from your heart, like, onto paper. Like, how do you... Because it's the same for any of the arts, not just music, yeah. But any, you know, painting and comedy and writing and, you know, whatever. It's how do you knock down the walls between, like, that sort of pure emotion and then deliver it in a way that is accessible and relatable without being on the nose and preachy? And, like, it's just sort of how do you get those blockades out of the way?
You know, I trust my unconscious more and more. I mean, if when I'm writing, I don't think about what I'm going to write consciously as much as I used to. If I'm asked to write a song about a specific subject, whether it's for a movie or whatever, I don't sit and stare at it for 2 days until something happens. I'll look at it, absorb the information. This is what I need to write about, and then I don't think about it for a couple of days, and I sit down, and it flows out of me. You know, most people have had that experience of trying to remember somebody's name, and they go, "Or a name of a movie," and they go, "God damn it! Wait a minute, what is the name of this movie? I know this movie. It's one of my favorite movies. What's the name of it? Or what's the name of so and so? God, we went to school. Cannot remember. You're thinking about something else, and it pops into your brain." Into your consciousness. And so while you were thinking about something else, you know, all the little, you know, filing people back there were going through cards and they managed to come up with this information. I think that our unconscious is spectacular. I think we're much more powerful than we realize. What I try to do is not stand on the hose. I try to not get in the way of the flow. And whatever creative source brings these ideas in the order that they do, it, you know, I mean, I'm a craftsman. I put my name on the songs when I write them, but I'll tell you, sometimes they come in a flow that just amazes me. I don't know if I told you the last time I was here to the story about writing the songs for the Muppet Christmas Carol. The story about Scrooge. Did I tell you that?
I don't think so.
Okay, this is interesting. I hope it's interesting. It's a fair example of what I was talking about. When I was maybe a couple years sober, I was hired to write the songs for the Muppet Christmas Carol. Great piece of literature for me to be writing about, even if it was Rizzo and Gonzo and all those guys, because it's the story of Scrooge, somebody who's had a spiritual awakening. I just had a spiritual awakening. So Disney, who has the Muppets now, is Disney, says we want the first song to be about Scrooge. And in the movie, you see Scrooge's feet as he comes out of the door, and it's Michael Caine playing Scrooge. And he's walking down this muddy, muddy road, and the snowy road, and as he goes by these little characters, like Rizzo and all these, you know, chickens and all the little people, they all seem to get colder as he goes by. So I knew that was the first song that I was going to write. I read the original Dickens novel. I read the screenplay. I know the characters. I know the Muppets. And I basically, what I did was kind of pray about it. I went, Big Amigo, I call it my higher power, the Big Amigo. Big Amigo, going to write this song about Scrooge. You know what it's supposed to be about. Let me know when you have an idea. I picked up a Lawrence Block novel, a murder mystery, and I started reading it. About 3 pages into it, I put the novel down, and I went, okay, he's walking out the door. When a cold wind blows, it chills you to the bone. But there's nothing in nature that freezes your heart like years of being alone. Whoa, that's not bad, you guys. That's pretty good, you know. It paints you with indifference like a lady paints with rouge. And the worst of the worst, the most hated and cursed, is the one that we call Scrooge. Oh, there goes Mr. Humbug. There goes Mr. Grimm. If they gave a prize for being mean, the winner would be him. Chris, I could not write it down fast enough. It came out of me almost as quickly as I'm singing it to you. And I know it came out of me, and I know that I wrote it, and I know that I was part of that process, but I just don't feel like I could put all the names on the piece of paper that worked on it. I think there is a spectacular energy, and I don't know if it's the generosity of Harry Nilsson and all the people that I loved that went before that are up there going, here, change this to that, whatever. I don't know how the process works. It, like I say, it's like electricity. I'm not sure how it works, but I know the more I stay out of the way, and the less I can, you know, ego is a sea anchor. If I throw my ego on and go, I'm writing this, and damn it, it's going to be good, it stops. But if I can go, I happen to be a part of a gift that I can be a small part of it, you know, and that's not false modesty. That's just me being in absolute awe of the creative process.
Well, I think you can. I think sometimes people forget that they can ask themselves for things. Like sometimes I'll have conversations with my brain where I go, okay, look,
okay, me,
yeah, there's some shit we got to get through, and you just have to focus. But once we get, you know, like if you can just hold off until, you know, this day, then we can relax. Now, a lot of times when I do that, I'll get sick on that day.
Oh,
you know, it's like
yeah.
the body,
oh,
you know, like
yeah,
push up.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think also,
great escape.
But I think also, you know, when you're trying, just like you said, and you're trying to write, oh, I got to find this thing. Why can't I find this thing? Oh, this sucks. And you get all caught up. But sometimes if you really just stop and get a little quiet and just say, look, you know, I just let me find in my brain, you know, brain, let me just give me the answer I need. Please let me have it, or please may I have it.
Yes.
And then, like you said, and a couple days later, I don't know, something weird happens yeah. and it just sort of like a little fissure opens up in your subconscious and then something just comes out.
It was time to be perfect.
I guess.
Yeah.
But it is strange that I almost feel like in some cases your brain is going like, hey, I'll... You just have to ask, sincerely.
Well,
you just have
thing,
to ask.
You know, the other thing that occurs to me, while I hear you, you know, incidentally, I love our conversations. I love our conversations because none of them are dead ends. See, everything you say opens up stuff in my head and all. But what I'm hearing you say is that you went, you advanced from problem to solution. And the way you did it is you discarded fear. If you stay in fear, nothing gets done because fear creates anxiety. Anxiety creates tension. Tension creates the lines around the nozzle, and boom, it all tightens down. It's that hose that I keep thinking about standing on.
Yeah.
But you let go of the fear and you jump into faith. That's why it's gratitude and trust for me. I'm grateful for what I've had, but I trust that I'm going to have what I need in the future, whether it's an idea. I mean, we sat down for this conversation. We had no idea what we were going to talk about. Maybe you had a sense of it, but
I
doubt it. You know.
That's why I love doing the podcast, is because it is essentially it's a ride for me, because it's basically just wherever we are in the moment, and that's just how conversations
yeah,
work.
Yeah, and it's a chance to learn. You know, it's a chance to learn for me anyway. I sit down here, and again, it's surprised. I still get surprised. I mean, I'm surprised at where this conversation went. Where we want the roads we wandered down. I love it. You know.
Well, yeah, it's nice because I think a lot of people who listen to the podcast are also looking for the same answers. A lot of them are creative types, and so they. Even if you're not in a creative field, there's still answers to life that people want to have. And you know, I'm not. You know, it's funny because I have this kind of faith in the, I don't know how to describe it, just sort of the scientific energy of the universe. But I wouldn't consider myself a religious person. But I just, too many times I've experienced this thing where I go, oh well, I decided I want to do this thing, and then this answer revealed itself.
Yeah.
Because I started down this path, and I, you know, I was kind to myself and said, hey, it's okay for you to, you know, and not in a greedy, like you said, ego way of like, man, I want a million, you know, I want this.
I'll take that too. It's
why can't I have that? But, but really like, hey, I just, this is something that's meaningful to me. And, you know, I would like to discover this more. And then it, and maybe it's, maybe those things, maybe it's that sort of, I don't know what it is. What do they call it? The reticular activation system. It's a part of your brain that makes you notice. Like if I say to you, the color brown, all of a sudden you see brown everywhere.
Everywhere, it's
like,
there's brown.
It's activating that part of your awareness to a landscape of things that were already there, but you just didn't, you just, our eyes weren't open.
Get a rag, we got to clean this up. Wait a minute.
So it's nice, I think, for people to hear. I think it's really great for people to hear, like, you know, even if you're going through a rough time and it feels like this is a forever thing, that there are things, there are steps that you can take, and you're not as much necessarily a victim of the universe as you think you are.
You know, and it empowers you. Just the beginnings of that kind of thought empowers you. So, you know, if you get, you know, you're having trouble, you get fired and you go, oh my God, I got fired. Where am I going to go to work? Assume that you maybe were released from that last position so you could find the place where you're really going to be able to do something you love.
I mean, I think, you know, with I'm sure with a few exceptions, but if you kind of look back at all of the major – every time you got unhired by Robert Zemeckis, or every time, like in my case, I lost a job, or, you know, like I lost a relationship, or I lost – you know, something, when you look back and then you sort of see like, oh, yeah, but if I had done that – I don't know. Maybe I wouldn't, you know, like this is pretty okay where I am. And
this may be maybe a gift.
I don't, or I've looked back on things that I thought would have been the best jobs in the world and gone, oh my God, I dodged a bullet. That would have been horrible that would have been a terrible path to go down. But I didn't see it at the time because I was too caught up in my own, you know, sense of, oh, I must have this for some reason.
What's that old line about more tears are shed for answered prayers than unanswered ones? You know?
That's a great quote.
Yeah, I don't know who's it was. Maybe it may have been Truman Capote. I'm not sure. You know, there's more prayers than there's more tears shed for answered prayers than there are for unanswered ones.
We've talked about all these great philosophical things that we've experienced, but then you mentioned something like, I had dinner with George Gobel, Flip Wilson, and Orson Welles. I'm like, what was that dinner like? What was that dinner like?
Well, the dinner was just Orson after the show and all. But, you know, but I worked with everybody that you just mentioned, you know, and did Flip Wilson's show and all. It's just amazing. There's a part of me that has never stopped being a little boy from Bennington, Nebraska. There's a part of me that, I mean, last night I did a show with Christofferson and, you know, and Steve Cropper and Bonnie Raitt. And all. We did this thing for the Grammy Foundation. You know, I'm sorry. I did a movie with Chris years ago. We did Stars Born together. People said, weren't you nervous writing songs for Streisand? Yeah, but I was really nervous writing songs for Kris Kristofferson, the guy that wrote Sunday Morning Coming Down, and me and Bobby McGee, and I mean, for the Good Times. I mean, to this day, I walk into a room and I look over and I see Bonnie Raitt. I see Kris Kristofferson, and part of me, they don't hear it, but something deep inside me goes, wow, look at your life. Look at that. There's a real writer over there.
Well, I said this. It's funny you say that because I said the exact same thing when I was walking into this building. I was like, I have the craziest life that I'm just going to go up and talk to Paul Williams, a guy that I'm kind of pals with now.
Yeah.
That when I was growing up, if you had told me that, I would have been like, oh, come on. What? You're crazy. What do you mean?
Well, I'll go one step past it. When you said talked about the energy the two people bring together in the creative process, and you talked about you and I went, okay, what could we do together? Because we could do, I mean, I would be willing to bet you put us, you know, away in a cabin for about 4 days, and we'll come up with the funniest idea for a movie ever.
I would fucking love to do that.
You're on.
I would love to do that. I want to write weird songs. I just want to write weird songs.
Ishtar 2 with songs.
Ishtar 2.
There we go.
Yeah, the movie that never got the sequel it deserved.
Yeah, exactly.
Really funny. Just to pick
anytime you want to do something together, all you know how to reach me. You have my phone. You have like, and we are friends and all. All you got to do, Chris, is pick up the phone.
I would love to do that. Oh my God, I'm flustered. I would love to do that.
In a heartbeat.
Love to do that. And then you all. Oh man, that's and so John. John's here. This is John
Lee Sanders, who's a brilliant musician and a great friend and all. And he played with me last night and all. So did you want us to...
I would love that. Yeah, John and I were talking a little bit before you got here because there's all these guitars on the wall. We're at ASCAP right now, and there's all these guitars on the wall next to the piano. And you saw Adobe... You saw... Your brother wrote...
My brother wrote Driftway. Give me the beat, boys, and free my soul. I want to get lost in your rock and roll and drift away. I mean,
that's a pretty insane song to write.
It's a rock and roll anthem. Are you kidding? I keep saying to him, are you sure I wasn't in the room when that bridge really sounds like me? And he goes, get away from me, you little bastard. Yeah, and he wrote it and produced it for Dobie Gray. And then, of course, it was a big hit with Uncle Cracker recently, too. You know, so, yeah, he's a good songwriter. He wrote To Win... We make love for Alabama.
Really?
When he writes a song, make has four syllables in it. Make love.
Well, John's here, and we had talked about when I heard that you were coming back into town, I was like, oh, we got to get Paul back on the podcast. I wonder if he would do a song or two. And then and so they said, well, he's up for it. What do you like? And I said, like I said earlier in the podcast, Rainbow Connection gets a lot of love and deservedly so, but I'm Going to Go Back There Someday is one of my all-time favorite songs. And they said, well, that is also one of Paul's favorite songs.
Well, here's the story behind it. It's an interesting story because we looked, you know, Kenny Asher and I were writing the songs for the Muppet movie. And there's a scene in this Muppet movie where they're all trying to make it to Hollywood. All the Muppets are gathered together. They're on the road to Hollywood and they break down in the middle of the desert. And Kermit is feeling like, I have just... failed everybody. I have failed everybody. And he's just, you know, he's lost in his own, you know, regret and sadness. What am I going to do to help these people? But Gonzo, who is a landlocked bird, and again, we're all landlocked birds, I think. Gonzo is out there looking at the sky. And Kenny and I went, what is it like for this little guy who is a landlocked bird to look at the heavens like that? So, John, you want to play a little intro to that? And so Kenny and I are thinking about this. We're imagining Gonzo looking at the sky. This looks familiar, vaguely familiar, almost unreal yet, it's too soon to feel yet. Close to my soul, yet so far away. I'm going to go back there someday. Sunrises, nightfalls, sometimes the sky calls. Is that a song there? And do I belong there? I've never been there, but I know the way. I'm going to go back there someday. Come and go with me, it's more fun to share. We'll both be completely at home in midair. We're flying, not walking, on featherless wings. We can hold on to love like invisible strings. There's not a word yet for old friends you just met. Part heaven, part space, have I found my place? You can just visit, but I plan to stay. I'm going to go back there someday. I'm going to go back there someday.
Yes!
And little, you know, and the funny thing about the song is that Kenny and I wrote the song and then went to Jim Henson because there was no place for the song in the movie, and he said no. He said, I don't think so. I said, you know what? Just listen to it one more time. And he listened to it. And it was quiet for a minute. I thought, well, it's all over. And then he said, "What if we do a scene in the fair scene where Gonzo buys some balloons, and he gets to experience flight? Helium balloons. He buys too many for Camilla, his girlfriend.
Yep.
And so he experiences flight. And rather than being frightened by it, He loves being up there. So we have something that is tangible for the people in the audience, the kids in there. He didn't say the kids in the audience. He never asked me to write for kids. Never write down to the audience. But the audience will have, there was this tangible moment where we can see Gonzo connect with, well, this, I've never been there, but I know the way. I'm going to go back there someday. At Jim's funeral, we played that. And I'll never forget that moment of him jumping into the creative process. And instead of saying no, saying, here's a way to do something really special where people get it. Where people get it.
That was incredible. I mean, so, you know, people just listening, they might go, wow, that's real. But to actually just be here and watch it happen, this was that moment where I'm like, is it okay that I'm here? Like, it's such an, it was gorgeous. Gorgeous.
You know, and if it's gorgeous and it's, you know, and if you, and you, you know, and I can stand next to you and say that it's wonderful too. What I then do is I have to kind of head upstream and find out what's the headwaters of that wonderful, and the headwaters of that are in Jim Henson. You know, it's just because I'm writing for Gonzo, which was this amazing creation of he and Dave Goltz and Jim. The opportunity that Jim Henson gave the people who worked for him to flourish. You know, when I wrote the songs for the Muppet Movie with Kenny Asher, at the first meeting, I told Jim Henson, "I'll show you. I won't surprise you with these." As Kenny and I are working on the songs, we'll show them to you to make sure we're on the right track. And Jim said, "Oh no, no, that's not necessary. I'll hear them in the studio when we record them." And I went, "Oh my God! I mean, I've never in my life been given that kind of creative freedom." And it just says about how much he trusted his choices, you know.
Well, that's an amazing place to get to, because it's very hard not to second guess yourself. Oh, is this the right thing? You know, to get that level of comfort.
Yeah, but trust of gratitude.
Trust, yeah.
Gratitude and
gratitude
trust.
Gratitude and trust. I know that, so on Twitter, you're I am the letter I, the letter M, Paul Williams.
At I am Paul Williams. The Twitter for gratitude and trust is at gratitude trust. Mm-hmm. The website is www.gratitudeandtrust.com. You know, what Tracy Jackson and I are doing is trying to take that feeling that you and I just experienced about this, you know, this wonderful surprise of being able to stand here and listen to something and rather than claim it and tie it down as ours, to see it reflecting back to all the things we've been given. That energy is so constructive and so powerful. And that's what we're trying to put into the book and what we're trying to put in the work we're doing. It'll be out on Penguin in October, in September. And I hope people will respond well to it. It's about recognizing the gifts we're all given and being grateful and trusting that when the time comes, you'll have what you need.
Well, I am more than grateful that we got to sit down and talk again. And this was fantastic. And we will do... You're going to be sorry you said that, because I'm going to what can we do this?
We have a responsibility because they all know about it. So
yes,
now
we're accountable.
We're now accountable. So, yeah. You know, but won't it be fun to chase it?
It will be. And yeah. I thank you so much, Paul Williams. I'm going to give you a hug. I'm coming in for a hug.
It's good
to see you, man.
You are a gift. And love to all of your listeners. And the response has been spectacular in the past. I hope we didn't screw it up this time.
No, I think we did. I think we did a nice job.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Yeah, we should record you doing it now.
What?
You should be singing it.
Me? Me?
Yeah.
All right, put it on the podcast.
Come on, here we go.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is my absolute joy to bring you Chris Hardwick.
I'm gonna screw up the bridge part.
Oh, I'll help you.
Okay.
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 This may be the perfect version of it. You take the first verse.
Okay, where do I come in? Right here?
Right here.
This looks familiar. Vaguely familiar.
Almost unreal yet. It's too soon to feel yet.
Close to my soul, yet so far away.
I'm going to go back there someday.
Sun rises, night falls. Sometimes the sky calls.
Is that a song there? And do I belong there?
I've never been there, but I know going to go back there someday. Come and go with me, it's more fun to share. We'll both be completely at home in midair. 'Cause we're flying, not walking, on featherless wings. We can hold on to love like invisible strings.
I messed that up, sorry.
No, it wasn't messed up. That was perfect. 'Cause now we get to go, there's not a word yet.
For old friends who've just met,
like us,
part heaven,
part space,
or have I found my place?
You can just visit,
but I plan to stay.
I'm going to go back there someday.
What?
I'm going to go back there someday.
And incidentally, that was the version we were supposed to do from the very beginning.
Oh, thank you so much. I love you. I love you too. I messed up that one word, but
it's like the Native Americans would sew, you know, a wrong thread into a rug. So,
yeah.
You know, because an homage to the.
Oh, nothing should be perfect.
Nothing should be perfect.
That's great.
That's the one you got to play.
You think so?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah, forget about mine, Jim. You can even tell them, say, well, you know, he did one there, but this is the one that he asked me to win.
Okay.
But you know what? The raw emotion of what we just did is the song.
Okay.
The other ones were me trying to recreate what just happened.
Oh, man, that's awesome. I'm so blown away.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of Nerdist is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10%, go to squarespace.com. Use the offer code Nerdist1.